So, welcome everybody to my first Dharma talk. How exciting! And as we know, today we're going to be discussing the First Noble Truth. I have it set up where I'm going to be, giving the talk, but there will be opportunities to jump in with some discussion questions because I do like to have it be an engaging experience. So I do have a bunch of content. We'll see how much I can get to. But the Four Noble Truths really represent the core, most central of the Buddhist teachings. So it is awesome to be able to cover the First Noble Truth. It is, a bit of a, it can be a difficult topic just because, we're just talking about how life is dukkha. But there's definitely a lot of hope and opportunity that comes just from examining this first truth a little bit more closely. So this First Noble Truth, as you know, serves as the foundation for the subsequent noble truths. It is the truth that life is dukkha, and dukkha being the Pali word for stress, dissatisfaction, pain. So the First Noble Truth postulates that basically inherent within life is dukkha, or in other words, stress, dissatisfaction, pain, and suffering are guaranteed aspects of life. There are also different kinds of dukkha. In my studies, I learned that there are different kinds of dukkha, so that's interesting. There is dukkha-dukkha, and that is with the kind of suffering that refers to a physical forms of suffering, along with the mental forms of suffering that stem from those physical forms. So things like sickness, old age, death, and then our aversion toward those things. So it's one thing to be suffering, say, from a fever or some form of sickness, but then it's another for us to then respond to that sickness with aversion, like I don't like this. I don't like that I'm sick. I wish this would be over. So dukkha-dukkha, physical forms of suffering, along with our aversion toward that suffering. And then we have Sankhara dukkha, which translates as the suffering of existence. And I retrieved a quote online that did a good job of explaining it. It refers to a basic unsatisfactoriness pervading all of existence, all forms of life, because all forms of life are changing, impermanent, and without any inner core or substance. So it's the ongoing sense that things never measure up to our expectations or standards because all forms of life are impermanent and without substance. So it's the suffering that comes from not seeing things as they are. So we suffer when we are ignorant to the fact that things are impermanent, empty, and without a concrete sense of self. So it's rooted in the ignorance of these fundamental truths of reality. And then we have Viparinama dukkha, which is the suffering that arises due to the non-acceptance of the truth of impermanence. So similar to Sankhara dukkha, although Viparinama dukkha is focused exclusively on the non-seeing of impermanence, specifically in terms of the changing of different states. So it's the suffering of change, of changing states. And this is often captured when we are, say, having a good time, and then we transition to not feeling so good for whatever reason, and the disappointment that then comes from that pleasant experience being over is Viparinama dukkha. So when we go from having a good time to not having so much of a good time, and then we're disappointed, we are suffering due to the ignorance of things just being impermanent, and there just being a constant ebb and flow to our changing states. So we tend to suffer, right, often. Very often, when pleasant experiences are over, or even while we're in the midst of a pleasant experience, we may find ourselves feeling anxious or distressed because we know it'll eventually come to an end. How many of you have, at some point, been having a really great time, and then in the middle of it, you're like, oh man, this is going to end soon, or I'm going to have to go home, and then you're just kind of right? So that is Viparinama dukkha. We're already anticipating the changing of the state, already in a way, perhaps even fast forwarding it by thinking about how this is going to end, creating a self-fulfilling prophecy where now we're making it end sooner rather than later. So we can see it very often when changing states from pleasant to unpleasant. But then, interestingly, it can also be reflected in the fear of changing from unpleasant to pleasant. So we may also find ourselves suffering in the fear of unpleasant experiences ending because psychologically we're hardwired to seek what's familiar. And if, for example, we're used to being in a state of general anxiety, of being chronically sad or whatever, the fear of change, even for the better, can contribute to people staying in that state rather than, say, doing something to get them into a more pleasant state because of that fear of change. And it's due to, ultimately, this fear of vulnerability or the fear of joy because it's vulnerable. So you can see that Viparinama Dukkha, in a way, even will affect our suffering when we are in unpleasant states, because we can anticipate that if we transition from an unpleasant state to a pleasant state, that pleasant state is going to go away. So might as well just stay in the unpleasant state because it's safer here. I know that I'm here. I don't have to risk being happy and then that being taken away from me or it leaving. It's easier to just be sad or to be anxious or whatever state that I'm in than to risk being in the vulnerability of joy and that then having to end. So Viparinama Dukkha. And this really stood out to me specifically because there is a researcher, her name is Brené Brown. She's amazing. She's a vulnerability researcher, has a bunch of books out, and she has a talk on Netflix called The Call to Courage. I would highly recommend it. And in it, she describes how joy is the most vulnerable emotion. Because when we're in a state of joy, very often, and I'm sure many of us can relate, and I'm going to ask us in a second to see if anyone would like to share, where we often, or we can find ourselves in a situation where we're feeling very good, things are going well, our relationships are thriving, our work is doing well, everyone is happy, and then all of a sudden the thought comes up of like, okay, you know, what am I missing here? When is the other shoe going to drop, right? Like what am I missing from, I feel like there's something I need to be anxious about, or I should be kind of on guard for something. So there's a vulnerability to being happy because we have experienced the changing of states. And so the fear of that state changing right then is Viparinama Dukkha, but it just alludes to how difficult it is for us to just be present and stay in that joy with an acceptance that yes, it will end. And so I'm wondering how many of us can really relate to that, like feeling really good, even if it's just like for a couple moments, or, you know, you just wake up and you feel great and it's a great day. And you have these thoughts of like, okay, you know, this is too good to be true. Or like, when is this other shoe going to drop? Who here would be able to share or even just comment? Okay, Leslie, what's up?
Well, I'm not sure if this fits into this particular category. I think it does though, but years and years and years ago, one of my very dearest friends, her name is Rui, she and I were getting an ice cream cone. And I remember we both had pistachio ice cream cones. We walked out of the ice cream shop and I looked at Rui. I had taken a lick of my cone. It was so delicious. And I looked over at Rui and she had this horrible, sad expression on her face. I said, Rui, what's wrong? Is your ice cream bad? She said, no, I just know that it's going to be gone in just a minute. And I'm so unhappy about that. Is that an example of it? I have thought about that story so many times about her. And this was a pattern. I mean, this wasn't a one-shot thing with Rui, bless her heart. She just could not allow herself to enjoy the pleasure of the moment because she was anticipating the moment when it was all going to be gone.
Yes.
Yeah.
That is an impeccable example. So thank you. Yes.
That's a special ice cream story.
Yeah, that's honestly perfect. And if you don't mind, I'm probably going to utilize it.
By all means.
Illustrate it in the future. Would anyone else have an experience that resonates that they'd like to share?
I do.
Sure.
So it actually happens quite often when I'm on my beautiful nature walk, and it's become a practice for me. And I do also know about Brené Brown, and I've thought about what she said before in this circumstance where, especially when we've had these like amazing days, like we've had recently where like the breeze is perfect, everything's perfect. It's like, and I'm walking around my 3-mile loop, which that I do like at lunchtime. And it's like, it almost like become a test for me that if I'm not able to fully receive the beauty of the nature, like if something is somehow constricting me, whether it's like the thinking about even something in, you know, in my work when I go back to my desk. But I think also like this kind of existential dukkha you're talking about, like this kind of feeling of like, this is so beautiful and so perfect. It's like, we're like maxed out here and it's only going to contract from here. And then like my exercise for myself is to stay open, you know, to stay open to it and to keep receiving the beauty in the moment. Yeah, it's very fascinating.
Yeah. That is another really great example, especially with like the weather. I completely have been feeling the same in terms of just how beautiful the weather has been. But just like with the weather, there are days that are beautiful. And, you know, being in Florida where the weather is very unpredictable, in 10 minutes, it could start raining. So it's really like a balancing act between keeping yourself open, like you said, and being okay with just like the changing nature of different states, that just because it starts to rain in 10 minutes doesn't mean that we have to constrict and close ourselves off. We can be open to that as well. And it doesn't have to necessarily mean that joy is gone forever. It's just a changing state. So thank you both for those examples. I think they really kind of help to make the content more relatable. And I know that we've spoken about that in the past. But when we kind of think in terms of how does this apply to my own experience, the material can go deeper. So yeah, you know, we got all these kinds of dukkha, sankhara dukkha, viparinama dukkha. And then we have things called kleshas. And kleshas are causes of suffering. There are five types of kleshas. There is avidya, which is ignorance, and that is not seeing reality for what it is, which is impermanent, empty, without a concrete self. And this klesha is the foundation for the subsequent kleshas. So in a way, you can see ignorance as the root of all other kleshas. Next, we have asmita, which is identification with the ego. So this is the source of suffering that comes from just identifying with an ego, with a permanent illusory sense of self. We have next raga, which is the suffering that comes from being attached to pleasurable experiences. So Leslie, like in your example, the attachment to, you know, wanting so much for that ice cream to last forever. And then likewise, we have dvesha, which is aversion toward unpleasant experiences. So then your friend being very upset at the prospect of that ice cream ending is the aversion toward that upcoming unpleasant experience. And then we have, last but not least, abhini vesha, which is the fear of death and clinging to life. So suffering that comes from our attachments to living and our fear of death. So we can see how, in a way, all of these kleshas are rooted in ignorance, where asmita, being identified with the ego, is rooted in some form of ignorance because it proposes that there is an ego, or not that there is an ego, but that there is a permanent sense of self to which we should be attached to. the attachment to pleasurable experiences, raga, is rooted in this ignorance that of impermanence, that pleasurable experiences do end. And then likewise, dvesha, the aversion toward unpleasant experiences, similarly, just the other side of the coin, being ignorant toward the impermanence of changing states. We don't have to go through an unpleasant experience and be averse to it. We can be open to it without that added aversion that just causes more suffering. And then abhinivesha, the ignorance and how that, or how the fear of death and clinging to life is rooted in ignorance, is due to the fact that death is a part of life. And to not, to be ignorant of that, to be in denial of death, would then cause us to cling to life, which would then just cause more suffering. So in some way, shape, or form, you can see the roots of all of these in an ignorance or in a non-clear seeing of the way things really are. This all can sound quite morbid as we've been talking so far, but there's a quote by Thich Nhat Hanh that I really liked from one of his books, where he says, the Buddha says that he only wants us to recognize suffering when it is present and to recognize joy when suffering is absent. And his reason for saying that is to point out that the point is not to see everything as a form of suffering because of impermanence, but rather just to see clearly how everything is impermanent, empty, and without a concrete self, so that we don't have to create, therefore, more suffering for ourselves. So it's not a bad thing that things are impermanent. It's more so aligning our perspective so that we can see the true impermanence and emptiness of all, so that we can go be with it, not resist it. And it's our clinging to separateness and permanence that really is the cause of further suffering. So, you know, we've gone over the different types of dukkha. We've gone over the types of kleshas. Why is this all important? So it basically just validates that life is hard and that there's going to be suffering in life, and it's not personal. By recognizing the innate nature of suffering within life, it helps to dissolve the ignorance that it's not supposed to be that way. And from that place of clear understanding and seeing, we can work towards not creating further suffering for ourselves. So the Buddha, with this first noble truth, is just right out saying, like, hey, life is hard. There is suffering in life, and it's going to come in these, you know, in these guaranteed ways, in sickness, old age, and death. But there's also other forms of suffering that are rooted in ignorance, and we don't have to create that further suffering for ourselves. We can work towards being more clear in our vision and understanding the true nature of reality being impermanent, empty, and in that way, true joy can emerge in the changing states. But we also, you know, that all sounds really nice, but we find ourselves in a bit of a predicament because, evolutionarily speaking, we are hardwired to seek pleasure and avoid pain. It's called the pleasure principle. And I found a quote from an article that I thought was quite interesting, and it says, at birth, infants exhibit two emotional responses, attraction and withdrawal. They show attraction to pleasant situations that bring comfort, stimulation, and pleasure, and they withdraw from unpleasant stimulation, such as bitter flavors or physical discomfort. So you can see, even as babies, we have this natural propensity to seek that which is pleasurable and avoid that which is unpleasant or painful. So we're born into a situation where, you know, suffering is a part of life, dukkha, but we're also at the same time born with this innate propensity to seek pleasure and avoid pain. So you can see how this dynamic would set us up for the kinds of self-created suffering that we experience throughout life. As we grow older, that instinctual attraction to pleasure, such as in the infant example, becomes a psychological clinging to pleasure, and our withdrawal from pain, that instinct to withdraw from pain, becomes a psychological aversion to pain. So we take these survival-based propensities, therefore, as truth. If my whole kind of body is responding and saying, I really want this because it feels good, it must be truth. It must be what I should be going for. And if my instinctual response is to withdraw from pain, it must mean that that is truth, that pain is bad, and I should be avoiding it, and I should be averse to it. So it's quite a, you know, a predicament if we're kind of born with these propensities to seek pleasure and avoid pain. But at the same time, if you follow that, it's what ends up causing a lot more self-created suffering. But despite this predicament, we are also born with the ability to cultivate mindfulness and acceptance and non-judgmentalness. So we have within us this innate ability to not be dictated by the pleasure principle. And that's pretty amazing. We have this superordinate capacity to choose where our attention goes and how we respond to changing conditions. I don't have to interpret my propensities towards seeking pleasure and avoiding pain as truth. I can, for example, be driven to seek a bowl of ice cream, but I can also choose to delay that gratification by going to the gym first, which would perhaps then represent the opposite. I am kind of moving towards pain and away from pleasure. And I have that ability, even though everything in my mind, body, and soul might be saying, I need this bowl of coffee ice cream. I have this superordinate capacity to say no and redirect my attention to something that might be painful, but that is ultimately good for me. So that is, I think, you know, where the work lies, is that we are, you know, I don't want to say fighting, that's not the word that I want to use, but we have these instinctive drives to seek what is pleasurable and seek that, or to avoid what is painful. And it's this constant ebb and flow between being aware of those propensities and then choosing mindfully where we would like to direct our attention, to be mindful of that urge to seek the ice cream, and to not necessarily give into it, to not be fused with that thought and emotion. So speaking of just delayed gratification, because I know it's something that is difficult for a lot of us in different ways, this idea of putting off something pleasurable in order to do something that's painful. How many people here, just by a show of hands, have trouble with that? Delayed gratification, right? Yeah, it's hard. Any examples that come to mind in terms of like something either recent or just even a memory that might come up where it was, you either were able to successfully delay gratification or it was difficult and you gave in to the bowl of ice cream?
Instead of waiting until the end of my work shift for my, you know, two or three pieces of candy, going, oh, well, it's, you know, I'm back from lunch. I should really have something to carry me through to the end of the day.
Yes, that's excellent logic.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing that. Was someone else going to, John, yes. Oh, you're muted, John.
You're on mute. Okay, can you hear me now?
Yes.
I wonder why my screen says muted when I'm talking. It might be something in my computer. Anyway, I think the bottom line is why I sit, to get away from thoughts. You get 60,000 of them a day or more. So you learn not to hurt yourself with your thoughts. And that's what the secret to sitting is, go back to breath. So you can learn to distinguish between hurting yourself, and you don't have to always have an ice cream cone, just go back to breath. And that's what sitting is about. That's why it's important to consistently sit 45 minutes a day so that you can learn and experience how not to hurt yourself with your thoughts, or just the opposite, you know, gluttonize yourself with it. You got to, it's about balance. And that's what health is balance. And it's really interesting to see how we can hurt ourselves with words and thoughts, because, you know, you have a thought, but it came from a word because we think in words. And so that's what I'm so love sitting and going back to breath. I can be quiet like that. Not still Forest Pond. I wasn't taking that on somebody else. But that's quiet when you sit and relax, chill out, and everything else, you know, balances. Carry it with you every day, every moment. That's kind of how I look at it. Why is it?
Yes. So what I'm hearing you say is just how fundamental and important the practice of sitting is when it comes to this practice of like delaying gratification, of not necessarily just jumping for something pleasurable or escaping something painful right. because of that sitting practice. And it has me thinking, you know, how many of us struggle sometimes to sit? And right, like it's something that we would think is going to be like, we tell ourselves like, or maybe I'm speaking for everybody, but you know, sometimes I have a hard time with sitting down for meditation. And I'm like, you know, I can get some stuff done first before I do that. Or so it's, we can see it in so much, not just when it comes to candy or ice cream or any other kind of pleasurable experience, but we find ourselves, you know, trying to seek what is pleasurable and avoiding what might be perceived as not pleasurable because of that pleasure principle. So yeah, thank you both for sharing. Delayed gratification is, if anyone has, you know, some tips and tricks for self-discipline, I mean, that's why we're here, right? To learn about all that. So, okay. So moving forward. So kind of bringing this idea of the pleasure principle and delayed gratification back to the first noble truth, by recognizing that suffering is a part of life, it becomes this fundamental first step toward not being driven by this unconscious drive to seek pleasure and avoid pain. Because if we recognize and accept that suffering is just a part of life, then we can re-engage with the process of life by not instinctively avoiding suffering and clinging to pleasure. We essentially develop a different relationship to pain and to pleasure. We can notice that just because some experiences might be painful doesn't mean that it's bad and needs to be avoided. And just because an experience is pleasurable doesn't mean it's good and that it needs to be clung to. It really is a duality. And by opening ourselves up to the duality of there being pleasure and pain in life, we can meet the painful aspect of life with an acceptance of it being a part of a larger whole. And we don't cling to pleasure because we recognize that it's impermanent and suffering will inevitably reemerge. We recognize that just because we have this drive to seek pleasure and avoid pain, it doesn't mean that we need to be at the mercy of those drives. Because being at the mercy of those drives would mean overindulging in pleasure and denying the reality of pain, which is dukkha in a nutshell. So not only is redefining our relationship with the pleasure principle key, but so is being mindful of the stories we create around our experiences. When we are in the midst of some form of suffering, we can end up taking that suffering very personally and create stories about how this shouldn't be happening to me. How could this be happening? I had such a great day. And because one of the core causes of dukkha is ignorance, which is not seeing the impermanent nature of reality as it is, it's almost as if we're surprised again and again when the states of feeling good and not feeling good ebb and flow, when suffering arises and pleasant experiences just disappear. So putting this into the context of some examples, say like sickness and death, it's a part of life to get sick and to die. And think about how distraught we can sometimes become when we are hit with, say, an unexpected illness. I was hit with like a sinus infection a couple of weeks back. I never get sick. See, these are the stories I tell myself. I never get sick. And then I got sick and it was unexpected. And I was, for a brief moment, distraught. I was like, how could this happen to me? You know, I never get sick. I thought my immune system was better than this. And that was due to my own ignorance of the fact that, hey, I'm human and I'm vulnerable to sickness. Or if a loved one dies, especially if a loved one dies violently, if a loved one dies or if a loved one dies unexpectedly, the pain and the grief is often overwhelming. And a lot of it oftentimes is due to these kinds of thoughts of like, you know, this wasn't supposed to happen. It wasn't in the plan. And that's not meant to invalidate the natural pain and distress that does arise in response to these events, like such as a death, but it's the layer of denial towards sickness and death that ends up amplifying our suffering and our response to these events drastically. We may have the propensity to believe that death will come in old age, it'll come later, young people aren't supposed to die, you know, major illnesses occur later in age, not in youth. And then when you learn that someone who's young dies in an accident, or a loved one goes through an unexpected, you know, major trauma, the shock and pain and the sense of groundlessness that occurs is in part a reflection of that denial. We are all vulnerable to death at every moment. We're all vulnerable to receiving shocking, painful news at every moment. And to be in denial of our vulnerability is suffering. And although we've all had experiences where that denial of vulnerability is reflected when we're in shock and despair over some awful thing happening to ourselves or a loved one, it leaves us in a state of groundlessness. Our vulnerability then becomes much more apparent and quite intimate, like in the wake of these very challenging or shocking experiences. We get to know that vulnerability quite intimately. But that's also an incredibly rich state to be in, because it's in that state of groundlessness that we see how our previous models of thinking and living weren't holding up, and we could see how our previous perspective was rooted in ignorance. Being in that state of groundlessness in the wake of traumas reveals the truth of ours and others' vulnerability, that bad things can happen at any time, whatever, you know, bad things mean, and that death, pain, sickness can strike any of us at any time. And so it's in these events that really, you know, break us down, that put us into the throes of suffering, that are often catalysts for dissolving ignorance. And that's the beauty that often then comes from suffering, is that we can leave these traumatic experiences with a firmer grounding in reality, more clear seeing, and a heightened presence and appreciation for each unfolding moment. So it's not all morbid. We brought it back. but, you know, this is really, it's real stuff, you know, to really talk about the vulnerability of each unfolding moment and how we are all vulnerable to anything happening at any moment. How many of you might relate to that experience of finding out, let's say, some awful news or being hit, say, with like an illness unexpectedly? It doesn't have to be something super, you know, difficult. I would probably encourage for us to not get into super heavy stuff within this context. In terms of someone being able to relate to that example of something unexpectedly bad happening and it then shifting your worldview and transforming it into one that is seeing more clearly or differently, if that makes sense.
April? I don't know if you can hear me.
Yes, who is this?
Oh, this is Sharon.
Hi, Sharon.
Yeah, it's interesting that this is correlating to Pema Chodron's new book, How We Live is How We Die. And she goes into all of this in the Bardos. And what it's helpful for me is getting that moment when you're talking about the realization that, oh, I'm sick, or, oh, something bad has happened, my car won't start, or, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. It's a matter of my instinct is to immediately panic or feel. What I find that the practice has helped me to do is to catch myself before that urgency begins with the, oh my gosh, and just be with the feeling and notice how it's developing within me, how the emotion is arising, and how, of course, I don't always have that presence of mind at the very beginning, but what I end up doing is being with it, and then I can stop it from escalating just by feeling it and letting things kind of smooth out a little bit, if I can say that, just by being with it. If I'm present enough to do that, then I'm really finding that it spares me some of the intensity that I don't have to endure, because it doesn't mean that my car is going to start if I go crazy, you know, with it. So that's kind of how I experience. I'm trying to experience things that are negative, that are not planned for, or things that send me off in some kind of a emotional spin.
That's amazing. And like, it takes, I know you mentioned Pema Chodron, I'm not sure how to pronounce her last name, but she's, you know, one of my favorite authors too. And I certainly did draw a lot from this last portion on groundlessness from her, because I was very inspired by some of her books. And it sounds like what you're doing is you're keeping an open heart in the way that she talks about it, like no matter the circumstance, and how that is, and like the characteristic of a spiritual warrior. And it's a characteristic of strength to keep your heart open, even in those difficult times.
I'm sorry. I was just going to say, the one thing I didn't say was it's okay to cry. And, you know, I consider emotions as something that if you are able to be with them, sometimes it's just a matter of finding a release, and crying is okay. Crying is one type of release, if that's something that helps.
Yes. I'm a counselor intern right now, and it's that is advice that I give to all of my clients is, you know, it's okay to feel pain. It's okay to feel emotions in general. And often there is even an aversion to crying or to that release. But like you said, Sharon, oftentimes if you just give into that release and cry for a little bit, you find that it was exactly what you needed, and that it wasn't this overwhelming experience, or you aren't like, you know, surrendering, or I mean, I guess maybe you are surrendering, but it's not going to be a cataclysmic event to open ourselves up to pain. And when we do, we realize it wasn't as bad as we anticipated, and possibly what was causing the pain to feel that much more painful was our closing ourselves off to it. And you get, the minute you give it like a breath of fresh air, it's like, ah, okay, I just need to cry a little bit. Like we're okay now. So yeah. And that, like you said, allowing yourself to cry, Sharon, is, you know, intertwined with this idea of practicing mindfulness of the body and feelings. So being aware of when your body is telling you we need to cry, because oftentimes we will unconsciously even repress that need to cry because we learned some time ago that it's not okay to cry, or that it's, you know, whatever. So to cultivate this practice of being mindful of the body and your feelings, so that you can tell the signals of like, okay, we need to express this emotion, is important to then be able to release that emotion.
It reminds me of when I was a little girl, my mother used to use a pressure cooker to cook a lot of things quickly. This was before the days of microwave and other quick ways. And it had some little thing on the top that would begin when the contents built up pressure. She would flip something. I don't even remember what she did because it always scared me. It made a lot of noise because you could hear it felt like it was going to explode. But once she flipped it and released the pressure, whatever released it, it was like, oh, okay. Then it was okay to open it. And essentially, that's kind of how feeling our feelings is, that we can have feelings that are intense. And when they are that intense, the building up of the feelings that we're feeling need to be released somehow, I think. That's sort of my take on it. But thank you for expanding on that.
Yeah, thank you for sharing. Would anyone else have a comment? Yeah, Steve.
Yeah, hey, Allie.
Hey, Steve.
Hi. Sometimes something traumatic happens and, you know, you've just got pressure and others around you have pressure and, you know, you get present real quick to what's going on inside you and what's going on with others. I mean, I just had that happen a month ago while in Portugal. Michelle's, who's my wife, is her mother was in rehab recovering and took a fall at night, and we had to come home immediately, and she died before we even got there. So meanwhile, there's a lot going on with her. There's a lot going on with others in the family. She needs to contact others and the medical community and just be present with it. I've got to just be present with how I'm feeling and how I am executing with others also. And it's just, you know, it can be really difficult and you can't just release it. But boy, you just have to be really present with what's going on, because you can hurt yourself as well as others in that whole process. And TAP Airways, by the way, they're the worst to deal with in this kind of situation.
So Steve, thank you so much for sharing that. I'm wondering, like, what was it like for you to stay present throughout all of that?
Well, I tell you, you know, immediately my wife, she's having difficulty with it. And, you know, we've got another week that we're about to leave to, you know, go to another city, to Porto. And, you know, I had to sit down with her and say, look, our trip is ended. And, you know, we have to get back. And, you know, just try to keep a really calm head. This is where, you know, John is absolutely right that, you know, when you've got a whole lot of things going on and, you know, you can become really emotional and harm yourself, you need to just sit and try to get through it as best as possible.
It's that equanimity that comes from being faced with so much going on, but despite it, you're not necessarily, you don't get overwhelmed by it. You are able to keep that level head, even in the midst of all of these, you know, changes and adjustments and difficult emotions.
Sure, that balance is critical. You know, I mean, we know impermanence. We know that, you know, it's a temporary situation. And, you know, you've got to be real observant of what's going on inside of you with your own emotions.
Yes.
And actions, right? Your actions all really matter.
Your actions in the sense of like your thoughts and emotions when you're in the midst of this kind, these kinds of experiences?
Well, there's a consequence to our actions. So, you know, we have to put our effort where it's needed and not just like freak out.
Right. And that takes mindfulness, right? Because there has to be a part of you that sees the inclination to maybe want to freak out or to have an emotional reaction and say, no, we have to be calm, we have to be level. So it, had you been fused with that emotion and you went with it, you wouldn't be able to keep that level head. So you're being mindful throughout all of this, or, you know, to the best of anyone's ability, but it sounds like your practice has really supported your capacity to be present in the midst of these kinds of experiences.
Everyone also has their habits, and sometimes, you know, those habits don't come up unless, you know, certain conditions exist. And boy, when something really traumatic happens, that's when you can see that arising as well.
Yes, especially. Thank you, Steve, so much for sharing. I want to ask Karen to jump in and share.
Hi, everybody, and thanks so much for letting me share. There's just kind of two parts to this. I had a friend that I studied secular Buddhism with off and on, and the last time I spoke with him, which was probably in December, you know, I said, well, how are things going? What's your teacher, his Buddhist teacher, what's your teacher talking to you about? And he said, oh, he told me I need to start all over again. And I thought, wonder why he told him that. But anyway, my friend Keith did pass away in January, and I think I understand now what he meant. But it's, so that's one part of what I wanted to share. And the other thing is just what brought me back, because I had studied with Peter when I first moved over to Orlando for a little while, and then I dropped out. But I had a herniated disc, a lumbar herniated disc with severe nerve root compression. And I've never been real sick, and I've never been injured, and I'm a nurse. And I mean, it took me, I couldn't walk. It took me 4 days before I would go to the emergency room, and I didn't know what was wrong. And it never dawned on me that there was something wrong with my back. But it was, we talk about dukkha. I mean, it was severe physical pain, and I couldn't walk. There were times when I couldn't walk. But I couldn't be still either. And just the nerve from the nerve disorder is what brought me back, you know, and thinking about what my friend Keith had said, his teacher told him, you need to start over. Cause I thought, I need to start over. I need to get back to the beginning and back to basics so I can just continue to learn more and cope with life, because it was not easy for me at all. And I am much better now. Thank goodness that's impermanent, but I still have some pains at times, but I can at least deal with them. And I can sit, as someone else had mentioned, I can sit for a while and meditate again, it was terrible. And it was really bad for me because I had never been injured or had any type of severe pain like that. And I don't want to feel it ever again, quite frankly. But I just, that's kind of what brought me back here. So, and I'm glad I'm here.
Yeah. Well, we're glad to have you here, and I appreciate you sharing. It's hard to share these kinds of things because they, you know, they remind us of periods of time that were unsettling and difficult and painful. But in a way, like hearing everybody share goes to show that how much it is just a part of the human experience for these things to happen, and how they happen unexpectedly. And they leave us in these states of shock and groundlessness. I really like that concept. And it's a great practice for mindfulness. I think Steve mentioned it as well, how it brings you back into presence, like when you're hit with something like that. And I think that that's very true. It's often been, for myself included, after some of the most traumatic and difficult experiences, that I have found myself to be the most mindful, because it's like whatever, you know, models I had at that point or whatever convictions I had were paled in comparison to whatever I was facing at that moment. So it really is a gift in a way, at times, because it shows you, you know, how we were still holding on to ignorance in different ways. That doesn't necessarily mean that we have to enjoy unpleasant experiences, not at all. But, you know, it's one thing to go through an understandably difficult experience, like going through something that's very painful, or, you know, as Karen described, or as Steve described with his example. It's one thing to experience that form of suffering, and then it's another to add another layer of suffering in which we tell ourselves, you know, this shouldn't be happening to me. How could this happen? We creating stories around it. We compound whatever suffering is occurring in that moment with our own ignorance, with our own clinging to pleasure and wanting to avoid pain. So with the Buddha saying that the first noble truth is that, you know, within life, suffering is inherent. It doesn't mean that by practicing mindfulness during unpleasant experiences that they will therefore become pleasant, but it just means that we don't create further suffering for ourselves, that we are open to suffering when it comes and when it goes. Any other thoughts on any of this that's coming up? Yes, John. Oh.
We're going with John first or Steve? All right.
Yeah, we'll go with Steve and then I think Sharon.
All right. So I'm okay. Yes. I wanted to reiterate something Steve said, that if you're carrying this balance, this mindfulness, and you then have someone that has a death experience, and he was saying, watch out for the reaction, because if you react, you can get it more suffering. Whereas mm-hmm. if you can stay balanced, you will share it. And it's kind of contagious. It's like if you've ever walked into a room with 100 people meditating, it's quite a wonderful feeling, as opposed to meditating by yourself. You see what I'm saying? That, and I always have to think that when Buddha said oneness, he was talking about everybody on the planet's the same if they're not hurting themselves with their thoughts in some way, judging, labeling, victimization, whatever you want to label it, crying. Peter's favorite is the selfing story. So if you can go back to that neutral place, I think that that's why we sit. And I really never heard it the way Steve put it. I like that, you know, and I liked what Karen had to say as well, because we're all touching on the same thing. So thank you. And Allie.
Yeah, thank you, John. So I know that we had a couple more people that wanted to share. I know we have around 10 minutes, so I do want to be mindful of that. But Steve, did you want to share something as well?
Karen, that pain that you experienced from herniation, I know that well, and went through it for 30 days while waiting for an MRI that was just being denied by the insurance company. And it's the most intense pain that I've ever experienced. And, you're present with it, because you can't sit, you can't think about anything else other than how do I end this pain? And it's a tough situation that you are in, and, you don't have any easy way to turn that off at all. I mean, you know, you could take hydrocodone and it's like candy. It does nothing at all with that kind of pain, nerve pain.
Thank you. I'm sorry you went through that.
Yeah, thank you, Steve, for sharing.
Yeah, same, Karen.
Yeah, I've been even reading, I'll make a quick comment before I ask Sharon, about some of the research just behind the benefits of mindfulness, and it was talking about how helpful mindfulness practice has been for people who suffer from chronic pain. And obviously, you know, that's maybe a little bit different from a herniated disc, but just in terms of the relationship between mindfulness practice and pain, it's not necessarily that the mindfulness practice will make the pain go away necessarily, but we just cultivate a different relationship to the pain, which then ultimately after time makes that experience of the chronic pain very different and often can diminish it. So it is really interesting just to notice the vast effects and the far-reaching effects of just being present and how that can even transform our experiences of pain. Sharon.
Oh, yeah, this is actually fitting into something that you made me think about, Karen, with your herniated disc. Years and years ago, I had sciatic problem because of an injury. And it just perpetuated. It did not go away. I was fairly young and active, and I thought I was going to be crippled. But I'm just going to say what ultimately helped sort of fits into this theme of our feelings. But this is more on a physiological level when you have an injury like that, because the nerve that is involved when it's a sciatic nerve or whatever nerve is being activated and causing that physical pain has to be interrupted. And I was very fortunate to find a chiropractor who was skilled in acupuncture. And the needles of the acupuncture, I have no idea how he knew where to put them, but he sure put them in strange places. And what I want to say about that is, similar in that interrupting the nerve that's transmitting that sense, that pain, on an emotional level, I think it's very similar. We have to interrupt that. And we can do that with mindfulness, whereas the acupuncture does it with needles on a physical level. In our practice, if we can, and I'm not sure that an MRI or any kind of medical procedure, this is where I have found help through alternative means, not Western medicine. And there are practitioners. I actually see a DO who does work with like the vagus nerve and other kinds of physical things that help to keep the body. A friend of mine calls it getting tuned up. and she's in her 80s and she's a weightlifter and she does all these physical things, but it's easy to hurt yourself. We're always vulnerable to pain, no matter our age. So it's important to have or be open to remedies that may go outside of our training of being trained to go to a doctor and get pills. Pain pills or whatever it is. So I want to just make mention of alternatives. And in the book that How We Live is How We Die, talks about halting or stopping and practicing what we have learned in our day to day. And this is just one thing she says. My brother used to tell me, whenever you're hungry, calls it HALT, H-A-L-T, meaning stop. Whenever you're hungry, angry, lonely, or tired, that's an instruction on refraining. And there's a chapter on the first step of courage is refraining. So, thank you very much for letting me share that.
Thank you, Sharon, as well. And I think that is in line with the segment before where we discussed like delayed gratification. It takes courage to refrain and to say, I'm going to put off, you know, the ice cream to do something else. So yeah, thank you all so much for sharing. I think it really enriches the experience when we get to share from our own personal experience how we relate to this material. So we are going to take a minute to just sit quietly as we normally do. And then that will be the conclusion of tonight. So let's take a minute. Thank you all for your practice. I wish you well.
Thank you, Allie.
Thank you, Allie. Beautiful job.
Thank you. Really good.
Great job.
Thank you, Allie. Thank you all. Thank you, Sangha.
Nice. I hope you have a wonderful night.
Thank you, everybody, for being here. It's good to see all of you.
Yeah. Thank you, Sandra.